The United Methodist Church is preparing to split over marriage equality.
We want people to know that they're not just welcome, but that they're affirmed. This protocol, this plan, if it's adopted, would allow us to get to that place.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for January 15th, a look at the global reckoning within the Methodist Church over LGBTQ rights. Also on the show, some advocates are pushing for more open conversations about salaries in the hopes of closing the gender pay gap.
It's okay to want money. Money is power in a lot of ways, and women don't have enough of it. And so I do think we need to be more open about our desires and it being okay to ask for more and to want more.
Plus, we hear about the Romance Writers of America having to cancel the annual Rita Awards due to controversy over racism and homophobia.
I mean, is there such a thing as an anti-reputation?
I think you just coined that term, but yes, go for it.
Romance has had this problem all along.
All right, let's get going. We start at church. One of the biggest Christian denominations in the United States and in the world is on the brink of historic change. The United Methodist Church, which has more than 12.5 million members worldwide, is likely to formally split later this year over questions of LGBTQ acceptance and marriage equality. In May, the church will be voting at their general conference on whether to split off the, quote, traditionalist wing of the church, which has pushed for Methodists not to recognize marriage equality or allow LGBTQ people to be ordained. Debate over these issues goes back decades, and for the past year, discord within the church has grown. Here's a clip from an emergency general conference that was held in February of 2019.
There are thousands of us in your local churches fiercely committed to a traditional definition of marriage, one man and one woman. I urge you, brothers and sisters, to vote no.
If we can be a church which brings Jesus to people who are told can't be loved, that's what I want our church to be, and that's the Methodist Church that I love.
And while the official split is still at least months away, we wanted to check in on how Methodists, both in the U.S. and abroad, are understanding this fracture within their church. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Joining me now is Reverend Tom Berlin, lead pastor of the Florist United Methodist Church in Virginia. Reverend Berlin is involved in the negotiations for the potential split. Reverend, welcome to The Takeaway.
Well, thank you for having me.
So how far back does this debate go about the question of LGBTQ inclusivity in the Methodist Church?
United Methodists have been debating this since the 1970s, when in the 1974, the language was first added that excluded LGBTQ persons from marriage and then from ordination to ministry, even if they were qualified. And so every 4 years, we have this general conference, which is our global gathering of the church. And this issue has been debated in every general conference since.
What happened in 2019? There was a shift in 2019's conference, right?
There was a shift. In 2019, we had a special call general conference, and the focus of that general conference was to simply focus on these issues, the presenting issues of whether we would be inclusive related to LGBTQ marriage and same-sex marriage, and whether we would be inclusive of people related to ordination. There was a special commission that had been created a few years earlier that was to come up with a plan. And that plan was focused on unity. How do we keep the church together in light of these important differences of biblical interpretation and desire for different practices? Now, remember, the United Methodist Church is a global church. So about half of us are here in the United States, but the other half are predominantly in Africa, but also in the Philippines and in Europe. So when we gather, there are a lot of views in front of the church related to these very important topics and these very important people. And so in 2019, when that happened, the tensions, after having debated this and discussed this for years and years, the tensions were very high. And in that conference, more traditional United Methodists in the United States persuaded and combined their votes with delegates from Africa, and they passed what was called the traditional plan. And it actually made it far more punitive for clergy to perform same-sex marriages. And that created a real shift in the United Methodist Church. Suddenly, people who were centrist said, you know what, this is a really important issue to us. And they became as energized as people that are progressive. And So together, that group met after the General Conference. And again, the 2019 General Conference was special session. But in 2020, we had a regular General Conference. So we were voting on delegates to go to the 2020 meeting, May of this year. When those delegates were elected in the United States, there was a increase in number of delegates who are centrist and progressives who believe that this is a important defining issue for the church and who would like to extend marriage rights to same-sex persons and same-sex couples, and they would like to allow for the ordination of qualified LGBTQ persons to ordain ministry in the church.
Some outlets are describing this as a divorce, a nasty divorce, if you will. But do you see this as a divorce, or do you see this as a natural evolution of the Methodist Church? And because we know that there are other religions, I've spoken to LGBTQ clergy who are rabbis, who are priests even. So is this a natural evolution given what was happening in the world today, or is this really a divorce within the church?
I think we were on our way to a nasty divorce. And the question is, what will happen in May? But the most recent development in this story is that a group of us came together, 16 leaders in the United Methodist Church. Bishop John Yambasu, who's a bishop in Sierra Leone, Africa, brought the group together. And he invited those of us who are centrist, progressives, and traditionalists to sit down. And rather than having a nasty divorce over this at the 2020 General Conference, the 16 of us entered into mediation. This group includes bishops in the United States and across the global connection. And in that mediation process, we've proposed a plan that is called our protocol. And the protocol is simply a document that allows us to agree on how a separation can take place in such a way that it's not a nasty divorce. We actually sat down and figured out, you know, what does everybody need to make this happen? And that process completely changed the conversation, and it changed the relationships. And so those of us who are in that feel that we're doing more the work of reconciliation now and less the work of divorce. Now, at the end of this, we're not all going to be in the same church. If the General Conference delegates vote on this legislation related to this protocol, people will be able to go their own separate ways, but they won't have to do so in hardship or in anger. They can do so in mutual respect and in the nature of reconciling love.
Reverend Tom Berlin is the lead pastor of the Floris United Methodist Church in Virginia. Reverend, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
For more on the United Methodist split, I'm joined now by Julie Zosmer, religion reporter at The Washington Post. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we just heard about how LGBTQ issues are driving the split in this church. Are there other issues behind the scenes here?
Well, when you have a traditionalist denomination splitting away from a mainline Protestant church, yes, there are other issues that they feel differently on, but really LGBT issues have been the driving force here.
So what is the process if the church in and of itself decides to split? What's the process for individual churches to decide where they want to go? Is it sort of almost like states' rights if we look at if we compare it to how the United States operates, or are there other decisions that will go into other reasons that might affect a church's decision to stay or go?
States' rights is not a bad comparison, because the way that the United Methodist Church works is that every church is part of a bigger body called an annual conference, which is basically just a regional body. I'm here in the Baltimore-Washington annual conference, which covers a lot of Maryland, for example. Every annual conference is going to have the opportunity to vote, if they so choose, to leave the United Methodist Church for the traditional denomination that's going to be formed. Here in the United States, most of the annual conferences quite likely will not have a vote like that. They will remain United Methodist. That means that if an individual church likes what their annual conference does, what their traditionalist in their annual conference decides to go that way, or they want to be part of the United Methodist Church and their annual conference is going to stay part of it, they're good. They never have to take a vote. And one of the goals of the group that came up with this plan was to avoid having votes at the local church level. They didn't want every church in the country to be voting whether to stay part of the church or not. That being said, some are going to say they don't like what their annual conference is doing, and they're going to vote on their own to break away.
What does this mean for parishioners who go to church regularly, who aren't involved in the bigger decision-making here?
I think everyone who has been a longtime active parishioner in a United Methodist Church has been aware of this coming split for quite a while. It's been discussed for years. The church just might not be able to stick together over this issue. And most have strong opinions. There are people across the country who have wanted their church to be performing gay marriage and welcoming gay clergy, who are eager to get this done with and to change the way things are done in the Methodist Church. There are others who have been increasingly uncomfortable being part of a church where more and more people don't share what they see as their biblical views of marriage. And they're eager for this path that lets them break away and lets them be part of a denomination that does not believe that homosexuality is acceptable.
We've also talked to Reverend Berlin in the earlier segment about the international influence here. Is it that he mentioned that there are some international sections of the church that are more conservative than here in the United States? Will the split become more complicated when it comes to what international branches decide they want to do?
I think what the United Methodist Church in Africa is going to do is one of the biggest questions about this split. Because, as you said, the African church leaders are far more conservative on this issue. By and large, they absolutely do not believe that the Bible condones homosexuality. That being said, you can't just assume, oh, they're all going to go with the traditional denomination in that case. They like being United Methodist. They like having Methodist hospitals. They like having Methodist charities. And there is a lot of sentiment in the U.S. United Methodist Church that says, we want to keep those African churches and we want to be as flexible as we can so that they can keep doing things their way as they believe fits their religious views and still be part of the United Methodist Church. So which way the African church goes is a huge open question here.
Julie, there's also more broadly across the United States, there's been a decline in those who identify as Christian in the United States. That number has fallen by 12% over the last decade. We also know that members of the LGBTQ community are also less likely to be involved in more traditional religions. Does that play a role in perhaps the church's decision here to split, to make sure that it is being more inclusive, just to increase the number of parishioners and the people who do identify as Christian?
Well, all Protestant churches, especially mainline Protestant churches, are certainly concerned about losing membership. And that is one item on the table here. But I believe that most of the reasoning here has to do with what church leaders think is right, not what they think is going to have the best marketing opportunities.
Julie Zosmer is religion reporter at The Washington Post. Julie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Amy Walter, and I'm the host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, we get behind the chaotic headlines from Washington and tell you how policies in this country are actually changing.
You're going to see access to health care determined by where you live.
Tribalism works.
There is a crisis of institutional decay.
Money follows power.
Join me each week on Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway.
Welcome back to The Takeaway, and I want to ask you a personal question. How often do you talk to your peers about your salary? Because for many people, it's a really uncomfortable topic. And understandably, in this country, talking about money can be even more difficult than talking about politics or religion. And yet talking about how much we make can sometimes help us understand what fair compensation looks like at work. So we asked our listeners if you open up about your numbers, and some of you told us, no way.
I'm Barbara. I live in San Jose. Talking salary is stepping blindfolded into a minefield. You will be sorry. You will be shocked and disappointed that you make less than your friends, whom you may think are not as smart, talented, hardworking, or educated as you are. Or your friends will be envious, angry, disgruntled for all of the above reasons, as well as labeling you a snob or a braggart.
Hi, this is Sharon from Portland, Oregon. I avoid talking about my salary except in certain specific situations. I always got the message growing up that asking people about their finances was impolite. But even without that, I'm embarrassed about what I make.
Hi, my name is Michael Lin from Maui, Hawaii. I do not talk about how much money I make with my friends. I like to fly under the radar, and I don't want people to ask me for money. I've loaned money to friends before against the advice of family and friends, and it hasn't gone well. Although I desire financial security and abundance, I do not want to be seen for those qualities.
Javier from Fort Lauderdale. I don't ever talk about salary with my friends. I feel like income is a very personal thing and has the potential to create conflict, animosity, or competition among friends. Not to mention, it could lead to someone feeling like a failure if their salary isn't on par with their friends.
But other listeners told us that salary transparency is a good thing.
Hey, this is Alexis out of Little Rock, Arkansas. I absolutely talk about my salary with my friends, my coworkers, anybody, because I believe that everyone should. When I did it in the workplace, it pretty much only brought about positive changes. My previous employer had tried to prohibit us to talk about pay in the workplace, but I pointed out that that's illegal in Arkansas. You know, I just thought about more transparency from that. I mean, they were not happy. Upper management wasn't happy. The owners weren't happy. Absolutely not. But that's one of the first things that we can do as women is start talking about what our male coworkers are getting paid and, or even our female coworkers.
Hi, my name is Cecilia Scheib from Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, on the outskirts of Philadelphia. I do talk about my salary with my friends. I would say we swap our salary info freely. It really helps me assess my budgeting habits, my spending, and compare my salary's fairness against my peers.
This is Edwin from Plano, Texas. I do share my salary with my friends. It makes me feel privileged to have the salary that I have, and I really hope that it encourages them to demand raises and organize in their workplace so they can attain the same things that I've attained.
Many of you who told us you did talk to colleagues and friends about your salaries were women. And openness around finance hasn't historically been the norm for women in this country, but that may be changing. And the shift is subject of a new piece in the New York Times called I'll Share My Salary Information If You Share Yours, from writer and editor Jessica Bennett.
I remember the first time I ever talked openly about my salary. Yeah, it was really scary. And I was scared that I was making too little and then would have to go in and ask for more, which was nerve-wracking. But then I was also scared maybe I was making too much and didn't deserve to be making that much. And then there was the concern that, well, what if my friends that I was telling were offended by how much I was making? So there's a lot of sensitivities around it. It was interesting in talking to different women for this piece, the younger generation, in particular Gen Z, those who are just entering the workforce. I think they've kind of been reared on this language and this vernacular around empowerment and around transparency. And so they seem to be the most comfortable talking about this, even in their first jobs.
Jessica spoke with financial experts, entrepreneurs, and many others for the article, which looks at the trend of women being more open about these kinds of conversations. And I asked her why she focused on women for this article, since men, too, can feel uncomfortable talking openly about salaries.
This all can be traced back to the wage gap in many ways.
Ah, yes, that, yes.
Yes, so that, you know, how can you know you're being underpaid if you don't have some parameter to understand what you're being paid? And we know that women in particular make less than men. We know that women of color make less than white women. You know, there are all of these things that you can't possibly know if you're not comparing yourself to those who are in the high paid bracket. So even when we talk about women sharing their salary numbers, well, that's not going to be incredibly effective unless you're also talking to men. But, you know, in an industry now where more people are working in the gig economy, where there are a lot of new jobs that don't really have information online and on payscale.com or salary.com, these places that are supposed to give you a range for what you should be making. So how do you really know unless you talk about it? One thing that is positive is that I think we are more aware now of the disparities. And we are not just talking about the 79 cents that white women make to the white male dollar. We are talking about the 54 cents that Latina women make or the 61 cents that black women make. And so we have a better understanding of these nuances. But I think that we need to be talking about these things amongst those of different ethnicities and amongst those of different genders.
So what do you
how do you start that conversation? I mean, like, other than writing a piece in the Times and having people feel comfortable reaching out to you, like, what can women do to be more open about this?
I mean, you can be really blunt. I talked to one woman who said it's sort of like coming up with a really good pickup line. You have to obviously be sensitive to who you're asking. I think you want to understand the power dynamics involved. You know, you're not going to go tell someone who works for you how much money you make, probably. You're probably going to be somewhat sensitive to the idea of talking to people who work in the same place as you. And sometimes I think it can actually be effective to understand what people are making in different industries to get a range. So I think, you know, it's like any sensitive topic. You have to be aware of some of the sensitivities involved, and you have to figure out how you want to bring it up. I think that sometimes referring back to research can be really effective. You know, I was reading this article about how women are talking more openly about their salaries, and sometimes that can help bring light to the wage gap. Would you feel comfortable sharing yours?
There are some companies that are supporting this trend. Is that right?
There are certainly a lot of organizations that are sort of celebrating this idea of women talking about money. So there's an organization founded by Sally Krawcheck, who's a former Wall Street executive, that's all about teaching women financial literacy. There's another organization that I spoke with called Ladies Get Paid that hosts a series of town halls where in some cases, the moderator will actually, the founder of the company will actually ask women to shout out their ideal salary numbers, which I think is pretty interesting. And there are a number of companies, as we were talking about before the segment, that have said, okay, we're going to be transparent about what people make so that we can potentially close any gap that there is. Salesforce is a company that has done that. There are a number of media organizations that have done similar. But, of course, you're not seeing the individual numbers. You are seeing brackets. Mm-hmm. So you can get a sense of if you're in the range. And in some cases, these companies are actually noting that there is a racial disparity or that there is a gender disparity, and they are putting money into correcting that. But it's not exactly like I know specifically what you make.
What are you gaining from these conversations that you've started in terms of showing women how to use that information to get more money?
Right, because you're probably not going to walk into your boss and say, well, so-and-so makes this much. I need to be commensurate.
And if you do, it's usually not the good, not the best approach. Right?
Yeah. I think understanding what the range is for other people. A lot of us, and I think a lot of young people rising up in their careers, take on duties as part of their roles that may not be defined in the role. So, you know, I'm an editor. Maybe I'm also doing social media, but turns out the social media editors are making $20,000 more dollars than my job title. Knowing that would be incredibly helpful if I were to then go in and negotiate for a raise for myself. I don't think I would throw out that I know who X, Y, and Z are and what they are making, but you certainly have a metric, and I think that it can make women in particular who often struggle with negotiation feel more confident going in.
Now, can employers retaliate against employees for talking about their salaries?
They are not supposed to. Private sector employees cannot. It's been in the law for a really long time. And in 2014, President Obama passed another law that applies to federal workers. But the reality is that the penalties are not particularly harsh. And so I do think you need to exercise some caution. I don't know that people are announcing, except I guess I just did sort of on air, that they are sharing their salaries publicly. They're having private conversations with people that they trust and getting the information that they may need to go in and negotiate. So I certainly wouldn't advise, if you are in a position where you are not comfortable or not in a power position, just announcing to your company that you are sharing your salary. Mm. What do you think?
I think it's a tricky situation. And I think that women, at least in my experience, still have trouble thinking that they're worth what they want to ask for, even if they know what the range is. And I wonder how much of that happens at not just the negotiating, and not just when you've already got the job, but at the negotiating table. Because they can't ask you what your last salary was anymore, from what I understand. But they can ask you how much you're
hoping to make.
What do we do there? I mean, you know, that's always a trick question, I think.
There's a woman, Cindy Gallup, who I know, who says, you state the highest number you can possibly get out of your mouth without laughing. And so I've thought of that often. But, you know, We're talking about deep-rooted biases in many cases. When women do negotiate, so for a long time, the conventional wisdom was that women don't negotiate. In recent years, newer studies have found that actually they are going in and asking. But even when they are often less likely to receive that raise and often perceived as pushy for asking or demanding too much. And I think these things get into your head. I think this is really deep-rooted, and it plays into how much we think we're worth or if we feel comfortable asking for more, or if we feel like we're going to be perceived as difficult or demanding or pushy or uppity when we do ask.
How should we, you know, should we be owning these conversations more without those feelings of fear or inadequacy that tend to creep up into the conversation when we do talk about money?
It's interesting, and especially in a creative field, you're sort of supposed to feel like you're lucky to be working and actually making a living in it. And I've often felt that throughout my career. You know, journalism is a tough industry at times. And so when I was interviewing women for this piece, one worked in the art world, and she was describing how there's very much this sense that, like, you are so lucky to be having a job at all, doing what you love, and that should be payment enough. And, like, that's not it. It's okay to want money. Money is power in a lot of ways, and women don't have enough of it. And so I do think we need to be more open about our desires and it being okay to ask for more and to want more.
Jessica Bennett is a writer and editor at the New York Times focused on gender and culture and the author of Feminist Fight Club. Jessica, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The country's most prestigious award for romance writing, the RITAs, given out by the Romance Writers of America, have been canceled. The decision to call off the awards came after a number of nominees withdrew their work from consideration, upset over how the Romance Writers Association has handled recent accusations of racism in the industry. Romance is the publishing world's most profitable genre. It's a $1 billion industry, and the Romance Writers of America is romance publishing's largest trade group. I have two guests with me now to talk about what this means for the publishing world. Mickey Kendall is a feminist writer and the author of Hood Feminism. Mickey, great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
And Concepcion de Leon is a staff writer covering literary news and culture for the New York Times Books Desk. Concepcion, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
So let's start with you, Concepcion. There's a lot happening here. For those who are not following every bodice-ripping moment here, tell us what's happening with the author Courtney Milan and Catherine Lynn Davis.
Sure. So this all started back in August when Courtney Milan on Twitter pointed out a few passages in Catherine Lynn Davis's 1996 book, Somewhere Lies the Moon. And she pointed to the passages and she considered them to be racist or to be perpetuating racist tropes. So there were references to slanted almond eyes. There was one line that was referring to women as demure and quiet, as our mothers have trained us to be. And she sort of culminated by calling it a racist mess. And this kind of garnered a lot of response online. Courtney Milan has a really large following. And Catherine Lynn Davis responded by filing an ethics complaint with the RWA or with the Romance Writers of America. And then in December, a few months passed. At that point, Courtney was the chair of the ethics committee at the RWA. She was asked to step down. And then a few months later, RWA issued their judgment, essentially, or their decision, which was to suspend Courtney Milan and to ban her from holding any leadership positions in the organization. Those documents were posted online by her friend, Alyssa Cole, and that's sort of where everything started to unravel. And a lot of people had really intense responses, really disagreed. Many board members, most of the board stepped down, and ultimately culminating in Damon Swade, who was the president, is the most recent president, resigning, as well as Carol Ritter, who's the executive director.
This is almost something someone could have written.
Yeah.
Mickey, what is the reputation of the Romance Writers of America when it comes to diversity and inclusion more broadly?
I mean, is there such a thing as an anti-reputation?
I think you just coined that term, but yes, go for it.
The book Courtney calls out is one of the older works, but romance has had this problem all along. They've had conflicts at conferences. Black writers have been insulted by writers at a conference they're paying to attend. There's been a lot of pushback that we don't need to be politically correct. We're romance, even if what you wrote is, oh, say, a Nazi romance. That exists. I can't have a
I was just thinking, okay, I hadn't seen one of those yet. But Mickey, we've been talking about, you know, just yesterday we talked about Oscar So White on the show, and this kind of reminds me of that. It's notable that the Romance Writers of America was founded by a Black woman, Vivian Stevens, but no other Black author has ever won a Rita. Like, how is this playing out?
So one of the things that's happening, unfortunately, is that when it comes to award season, the people reading your category are not people who write in that category. Sometimes they're the exact opposite. So let's say you are writing queer romance. Your book might be being judged by a conservative Christian writer whose work is explicitly anti-LGBT.
I see.
You have this thing, then, what happens where, for reasons, the structure of RWA, I'm sure unintentionally, makes it possible to continuously lock out certain groups from the Ritas just by sheer numbers. And then by that virtue of that, the most prestigious award and the things that go with that award, then we can claim that it's a quality problem without ever discussing the judgment.
Concepcion, I want to get back to you, too, because as we mentioned earlier, the top leaders at the RWA have resigned in response to the controversy, including the executive director and the president. What about Catherine Lynn Davis? Was she ever reprimanded for this? Was she ever asked to change the language used in that? What steps has the organization taken to address the situation other than dealing with Courtney Milan?
I think as far as Catherine Lynn Davis is concerned, as far as I know, no further action has been taken. I think she has sort of removed herself from the situation. And in my conversation with her, she told me that she was an honorary member of the RWA, so I don't know how involved she was to begin with. But in terms of RWA, they committed to doing an audit of their investigation, an independent audit of the investigation, and have said that they're going to have certain different forums and opportunities to talk about diversity at the RWA. I do want to say, you know, I do agree that one of the things that I learned when I was talking to different romance writers was that this is a longstanding problem. And what is interesting about this is that the Ritas last year, two Black women did win. And so to them, that was sort of, it kind of inspired a bit of optimism. I think that things were changing. And so for all of this to happen after that, after two Black women won for the first time in the awards history, I think is particularly hurtful for people.
What are the fans saying, Concepcion?
I think it's similar criticism. I think there's a lot I will say in my reporting, I didn't speak to fans specifically, but just seeing what's going on online and the responses that they're having, it is a similar sort of passionate response. And I think a lot of people didn't realize what was happening behind the scenes. You know, people maybe read the books, but didn't actually realize what the experience of actually being in the industry was. So I think there was a lot of expression of sort of dismay and disappointment.
Mickey, I think we tend to look at this genre as unimportant, and yet it is a $1 billion industry here. It is one that is a juggernaut for many folks. I mean, what does this case or this example mean, or could it mean, for publishing more broadly?
Well, it's one of these things where if you're in media and you say, oh, it's quality, it's not diversity, it's quality, and you don't look at how things are structured, you could believe that, well, no one has written a book good enough to win. And then you realize, well, people have, but mostly we're having these kinds of disputes about what should even be considered part of the genre, who's allowed to speak up and critique works in the genre, punishing people for criticizing racist tropes, things like that. And broadly, it means that you're either going to end up with media that's not very good, even if it is quote unquote not politically correct, or you're going to end up blocking out huge chunks of the audience and then saying, as we've seen publishing and other industries do, well, people have stopped, comic books are over, video games are... Well, no, what happened is someone figured out, you don't want my money, so I'm going to take my money over there to the genre appealing to me. And in publishing, especially with romance, that has largely been self-pubbed authors of color. If you're not writing for one of the major houses and you've self-pubbed, you're getting an audience. And some of this dispute is about the right to an audience, to the idea that the audience is supposed to accept whatever you put out without pushing back. Because ultimately, writers are fans of the genres they write in.
Mickey Kendall is a feminist writer and author of Hood Feminism, and Concepcion de Leon is a staff writer covering literary news and culture for the New York Times Books Desk. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.